Good evening. Today is January 12th. I believe this is the seventh lecture, even though last week on the 5th I said it was the fifth lecture, so I think it was really the sixth. So I have to go back. I think I have, this is number seven. Okay, last week we were discussing Poland, but we were discussing more of the history of Poland, how the Jews came to Poland, and we spoke more about like the infrastructure and you know the I guess the life and times of people in Poland, how the structure was in the shtetl and how Torah was being taught. We also spoke about the fairs, that there were two fairs during the year, and how, like, for the first 150 years in Poland, everything seemed to work. Everything seemed to work well, and the Jews in Poland were doing very, very well. They exploded, like, in 100 years from 10 times, from 50,000 Jews to 500,000 Jews. Clearly, by the 1600s, it was by far the largest community in the world of Jews. Okay, this year, I wanted to go back and discuss the Rabbanim, the Yeshiva, the Torah aspect. I guess I try to do three things. First, get the overall outside history, what's going on. Secondly, is how does the history, what's going on, relate to the Jews? And then what's doing with the Mesorah? What's doing with the Torah, with the Rabbanim? So tonight I'd like to talk about the Rabbanim. And we have two main Rabbanim that we're going to talk about. One is Rabbi Yaakov Palik, and we're going to see interesting things happen to Rabbi Palik and his student Rav Shalom Shachna. Rav Shalom Shachna is the father-in-law of Rav Moshe Isserles, the Rama, which we're going to be speaking about afterwards. That's like the crown, the glory of Polish Jewry would probably be epitomized by Rev the Rama, Rev Moshe Isserles. But tonight we're going to start with Rav Palik. So Rav Palik, he must have been some like outstanding student, scholar, genius. He was in the yeshiva of Rav Yaakov Margolis in Nuremberg. Now, in that yeshiva was known as, it was like a pilpul yeshiva. Now, there's a certain type of learning of pilpul. It's called a pilpul type of learning, pilpul. The pilpul that was done in Poland, it seemed to have been, well, let's put it this way. Pilpul is part of learning. Pilpul means to go into, pilpul literally means pepper. But it means like the spice of learning. Like you'll ask a question, and then you'll ask another question, and you have to, you know, split hairs, so to speak, to find the answer. So the Gemara says that one of the three, four questions after a person dies, he's going to go up to Shemayim, they're going to give everybody a test. And they're going to ask everybody the same question. One of the questions they're going to ask is, Pilpalta b'Torah. Did you learn with Pilpul? Did you learn like with Ian? Did you wait for Mashiach? These are questions that they ask everybody. So from always, there was always a matter of learning and learning with making splits and understanding and learning in depth. So that was always part of learning. In Poland, there was a certain type of a pilpul that we generally don't do it anymore, but to try to figure out what was this pilpul, because many, many gedolim really speak out against it. And they were, they were very, very much against the pilpul that was being done in Poland. And where did this pilpul come from? It came from Rav Yaakov Palik. Rav Yaakov Palik was very into pilpul, and when he came, he brought with him a pilpul type of a learning, and this pilpul type of learning grabbed the masses. It made Torah exciting. It made learning exciting. It seems that the learning in Poland, there's so many people who are so into learning, almost like unparalleled anywhere else. The masses were really into learning. The only thing is they were, and we're going to see what some of the issues may have been, but some of them felt it was getting too carried away. And it wasn't really MS. It wasn't really what was supposed to be in the learning. Well, maybe we'll get back to that. But okay, he studied in Yeshiva Margolis, and he brought this method of learning of Pilpul, where first he was a Rav in Prague and then later in Krakow. This was I guess I didn't have it here, but this was a approbation. Reputation of Rav Yaakov Pollack was known from one end of the earth to the other. He was very, very famous, a very big, big Talmud Chacham. He died around the year 1530. Okay, so Rav Yaakov Pollack, again, he was very into Pilpul, and again, the type of Pilpul really, really sharpens the minds. It's very, very helps a person sharpen the mind and figure out what did the Gemara mean, what could it have meant. Okay, and this is a quote from the Tzemach David. So he's like, in his book, it was like a little bit of a historic work. So he was... I guess I'm not available. Okay, so that's what he writes. This is Rav Yaakov Pollack. And but first he was in Prague, and he was with the he had a yeshiva together with Rav Isaac Margolis. Rav Isaac Margolis was the son of his Rebbe, Rav Yaakov Margolis. So he was originally he was in Prague, and then something happened. He was married to a fine family, a rich family. So basically, Baruch Hashem, he had everything. He had riches and he had Torah, and everything was fine. However, an issue happened. It was caused a tremendous, tremendous rash, you know, inside the Jewish world. And that was as follows. It was an issue with a miyun. I don't know what a miyun is. His wife had a younger sister, and she was younger than 12, and his wife's father passed away. So there was only a mother. So one daughter was married to Rav Yaakov Pollack, and there must have been a very younger daughter, and they married her off to somebody else. Her name was Silka, I believe. So she was married off to somebody else. Anyway, that marriage didn't work out. So what do you do? She's a katana. She's less than 12, and she doesn't want to be married anymore. So in the Torah, the Gemara brings down that there is such a thing called miyun. Now let me backtrack a bit. When a woman marries a man, when the man gets married to a woman, so that is a kedushin, that's a marriage from the Torah, min haTorah. Okay? Now, a katana, a child, a girl, a young child, can't get married min haTorah. Right? She's too young. She doesn't have the das. She's not able to make the kinyan. There is a way, however, for a younger child to get married from the Torah, and that is if her father marries her off. So if her father accepts the kedushin for his young daughter, Katana, she could be married, min haTorah. What happens if she doesn't have a father? So the Rabbanan, they made this rabbinical marriage. And the rabbinical marriage is that she's only married midrabbanan. And, so min haTorah, she's not married. Only the Rabbanan said that they allowed such a marriage to take place. Why did they? She could be married off by her mother or her older brother. But that marriage, being married off by a mother or an older brother, is only rabbinic. Because it's only rabbinic, they allowed this girl that if she no longer wants to be married, she's allowed to just say, I don't want to be married anymore, and leave without a get. Okay? That is That's what they determine.
Is that at any age or at the age of 12? Only younger than 12.
Once she's 12, that's it. She has the ability to accept a kedushin, and the Torah recognizes that. So she's married min haTorah. Younger than that, they would go through the you know, the kedushin hariyat mekudeshes. Maybe they would do that anyway, but she's not married min haTorah, only rabbinic. And rabbinically, if she wants to separate, she does not need a get. All she has to do is miyun, refuse. She says, "I don't want to be married anymore," and they could separate. Now, what happened is the Reb Yaakov Pollack's wife's younger sister was a katana, and she was married to somebody else, married off by the mother. Again, the reason why the Chachamim allowed this is because they realized through gullus, or they realized situations, if you have young girls and they're not taken care of, they're not cared for, so bad things can happen. So what they did, they decided, they figured, you know what, it would be better off, let her be rabbinically married to this person, this man, and that's it. And then she'll grow up. Once she turns 12 and she did not do miyun, she's married. Does she have to consummate the marriage after she's 12? Maybe she should get a kedushin after she's 12. That could also be. But as long as she does not, she has to do miyun. She has to refuse before she turns 12. So Yaakov Pollack's sister-in-law was a young child, married off by the mother, and that's it. Before she turned 12, she no longer wanted to be married to this person. It didn't work out, and she wanted to separate. Now, this caused, Rav Yaakov Pollack said, that the child could do miyun. Okay, that's what he said. However, there was already in history... this is a Chuvas of the Marie Mintz. So he brings this down. This is starting from the year 1492, that he brings a miyun, annulment of a rabbinically sanctioned marriage of an adult male to a minor female, originally made under the auspices of a mother or the brother of the girl. This was, her name was Miss Silka. Okay, she was married to Reb David Senner. Okay. Now all the rabbis of the area declared that this miyun was invalid. No miyun. Why? Because there was a Rav Menachem of Merzburg, who made it so, and he decided that because we don't know as much, or we're not so familiar, he made a decree at the Kana that no longer should miyun be allowed. So if an 11-year-old girl was married rabbinically, she wants to get divorced, she has to get a get. Okay, well, she can remain married, she doesn't have to, but if she wants to leave, she has to get a get. However, and it seemed that most of the Rabbanim sided with Rav Menachem of Merzburg. However, Rav Yaakov Pollack disagreed. He was the sister, he was the brother-in-law, and he paskined. He said, "No, even still, she can do miyun." Now it was to such a point that all the rabbanim, even his rebbe, Rav Yaakov Margolis, actually put Rav Yaakov Pollack in cherem for his stance. And that stance was also putting in cherem also comes with it a curse. And this is in the Chuvas of the Marie Marins. He's bringing this down and he's quoting, this is what happened, this is the history of it. And then he goes on and he says, I agree with all the Rabbanim. And he says, look, you know, we should, all the Rabbanim, they're the majority. And they all disagree with Rav Yaakov Pollack. And that is what is the halacha. However, he ends up saying, he says, however, the cherem is not so pashut. The fact that, you know, this is himself talking. And the fact that you put him in cherem, there is room, Rav Yaakov Pollack has room to move. In other words, there is halachic basis for Rav Yaakov Pollack. decision that Minyan should be allowed. Again, we should try to enforce it, try to get them back together. They should try to get, and if they do get back together, they should need another Kedushin. He actually brings a Shaila, and the next thing is if they do get back together, do they need another Bracha? If they do decide to remain together, will they need, somewhere yet in his, he says, should they have another bracha? Because there's a shaila, if you need a kedushin, after all, they're sort of married rabbinically, does the kedushin need a bracha? Okay, that was his shaila. But basically, he says that the fact that they put him in excommunication, that I disagree with. I do agree that that should be the halacha. Okay, so that's what, but in any case, because he was put into cherem, he had to leave Prague, and that's when he went to Poland. Okay, so he left Prague because of this issue, and he went to Poland. Now, to be put into cherem and to be put on, have a curse, is not good. And we're going to see towards the end of his life, actually, Rav Yaakov Pollack may have been put in cherem a second time. And at the end of his life, we'll see something happen that it most likely could have been because of this curse.
What years are these?
So this is, again, in the early 1500s. I'm telling you, about 14, probably in 1490s, late 1490s, early 1500s. I think actually it actually may have said a year here. 1503, I thought I saw somewhere. Well, very recently, around 1492. Responsive for multiple brothers and teachers. Okay, so I guess the issue started in 1492. He was 30 years, over 30 years in Poland, and he died in 1530. So this must have happened in the 1490s, I guess. Okay, the only question is like we, it doesn't bring down over here what was Yaakov Pollack's reason to allow it. In other words, this Reverend Menachem Merzberg. Came before, and he said not to do it, and all the Rabbanim agreed not to do Mian. So, like, what was the position of Rav Yaakov Pollack? And the answer is because this rabbinic marriage is very, it's not so pashut, it's not a simple thing. Because let's say it's only rabbinic, right? So you have this girl who's rabbinically married to this man, right? And let's say, for example, that she'd grow older and she'd be a few years and she'd become an adult, and let's say the husband didn't give her another kedushin, or they didn't consummate the marriage, and let's say what would happen if somebody else would go to this girl and give her a kedushin? What would the halacha be? Who would she be married to? She would be married to the second person. Because the first Kedushin was only Drabbanan. Be a big issue. What would happen if the husband gave, let's say she's still a Katana, what would happen if the husband gave this girl who she's married to, his older sister, a Kedushin? Right now, a person cannot be married to two sisters at the same time. Right? So, you know, he really would be married to the older sister and be aser to his younger sister. So in order that people should realize that it's a rabbinic marriage, Miyun is very important. Because what does Miyun tell you? Miyun tells you that she could say goodbye. That's it, I'm leaving. I don't want to be here. And that's it, and she leaves without a get. What does that tell you? That the whole marriage was only rabbinic. But if you're not going to, you're going to say that you can't rely on Mian, and you're going to need a real Kedushin, then how are you going to know that this Kedushin is only rabbinic? You may think it's Minotaurah, it's right? And then if she accepts a Kedushin, crazy case, but if she accepts a Kedushin from somebody else, then she would really be married to somebody else and she'd be an Eish HaSish. So in order that everybody would know that it's rabbinic, they allowed Mian. Okay, maybe this was the rationale for Rabbi Yaakov Pollack. But in any case, but because of this, that's it, he left. He had to leave He had to leave, and he ended up in Poland. But just you should just know, the Shulchan Aruch and Evin Ezer, this is the Machaber and the Rama. The Rama, Rav Moshe Isserles, who's a Talmud and son-in-law of Rav Shachna, who is the Talmud, who took over, who was a Talmud of Rav Palik, paskins like Rav Palik. So in Poland, they actually paskin like Rav Palik. He says there are those who say we should be stringent today, not, this is the Rama. Right, so actually, the this could be the Machaber. There's those that we say that should be stringent today, not make mian after the girl is 12 years old, even though she was examined, they didn't find any hair, nor did she have any marital relations after she reached the age of 12. So I'm sorry, the Machaber here is saying that after 12, even if nothing else happened, that's it. She can't do mian anymore after she's 12. So let's say she turned 12, but she was not with her husband, or, you know, the husband was not Makadisher. So the Machaber says you should be stringent. You can't allow a Mian after 12. The Mian, the refusal, has to be before she's 12. But before 12, the Machaber holds you could do Mian. The Rama, and this is right in Poland, according to all opinions, if she is less than 12, she can invalidate the marriage through Mian, even in the present day. This is the ruling which Rabbi Yaakov Palik of blessed memory made in his own lifetime. This ruling differs from those who were stringent and stated that no girl should make mian in the present day. So you see, the Rama paskins like Yaakov Palik. Machaber is the Beis Yosef. So the first said Machaber Sfardim, right? So that was the Sfardim. Clearly, the Sfardim said you could do mian. It was only Rav Merzberg, for it was a big Rav in Germany at the time, said you should not do mian anymore. Among German Jews, they didn't practice mian.
Isn't this the Machaber who says you shouldn't do Mian?
After 12.
After 12,
which means before 12 you could
so
do Mian.
So both the Rama and the
Machaber, they all paskin agree that, yeah. Right, and we, I guess, paskin.
This girl was Rabbi Pollock's sister-in-law.
Correct.
Did that have any impact on
Yes, and that's what they were saying, because, you know, I'm sure because he was his sister-in-law, he felt more involved in the case to try to get her out of it.
No, Gabadava.
They also said that because he coached her, he shouldn't have coached her, and he was, since he knew to coach her, me, and maybe she wouldn't have done me, and but that probably changed a few factors, or at least in people's mind, because he was the brother-in-law. Okay, so that was one thing, and made him go to because it was okay, and the Yamshel Shlomo, which is Rav Shlomo Luria, who's like a cousin to the Rama, or to the Marshal. We know him either as the Marshal in the back of the Gemara, the Yamshel Shlomo. He also writes, because of his prestige and greatness, he relied on his own opinion to validate Mian, and not to pay attention to them who did the decrees. The woman, Silka, did get married to another man on the basis of the Mian. Okay? That's also the Marshal in Halacha. He was like very strict, boy. He was, you know, so he also sounds like he also paskin like Rav Yaakov Palik. Anyway, this is the letter when he came to Poland, Rav Yaakov Palik. So he became the chief Rav, I guess. And it could be, it almost sounds like that Rav Yaakov Palik was like the, you know, like head and shoulders above his generation in terms of lumdus, in terms of understanding. I'm not sure about that, but that almost what it seems, what it was. So this is the confirmation of Rav Yaakov Palik from the office of King Alexander Hegloni. We, King of Poland and Grand Duke of Lithuania, hereby confirm Rabbi Yaakov Palik as Chief Rabbi of Krakow and of all the Jewish communities because of his great knowledge of Hebrew studies. All of the Jewish communities in the city of Krakow, as well as the Jews of Poland, are required to obey him and to honor him as head of the community, the ultimate authority in legal decisions, with the power to institute community-wide customs, to fulfill all responsibilities of the office of the Chief Rabbi. So that's it. He was acknowledged as the chief rabbi.
So amazingly, as Gabbai today, I had the honor of giving an aliyah to the current day chief rabbi of Krakow.
Really? Okay.
Yes. Which is an amazing story with what's going on there now.
Right, the revival, you mean?
There's
a tremendous. I was in Krakow a few years ago. It was amazing. It was just amazing to see there. Okay. What's his name?
Rabbi Avi Bamol.
Bamol, okay. So which shul is it? He's not in the...
No. He's working more out of the JCC.
Right, that's what I thought.
And he said there are five different shuls that are operating in Krakow.
And he's in charge of all of them.
He's in charge of all of them.
Okay, right. Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. and he reports to the chief rabbi of Poland. I didn't catch the name of who that is.
Okay. Well,
it's amazing
that there is such a thing now because of all the trips. Right. Krakow became.
When they were at a point where they thought there was no Judaism there at all, just like.
Judaism in Poland is because of revived because of all of the living the March of the Living and all of the tours that are being taking place every year. You know, hundreds of people are going to visit the camps and the old shuls and the shtetlach. Okay, Marshall quotes Rabbi Yaakov Pollack. If you forgot to say, now Rabbi Yaakov Pollack, you know, he was the, just, this is a shayla, I don't know if we paskin like this. If one forgot to say Al-Anisim in Purim, does one have to repeat Berachos HaMazon? And he quotes that you should, but I don't think we is a ruling found in the manuscript of the Mordechai, which was corrected by Rabbi Yaakov Pollack. Okay, so I don't know if we paskin like this, Marshal. I don't think we repeat Al-Anisim, but just he's quoted by the Marshal. Okay, now this next thing comes from the Sefer Shalshelas HaKabbalah. Shalshelas HaKabbalah is also a Sefer that is like a historical Sefer, brings different things down. However, there are things that he just compiled it. He didn't always check it for its accuracy. So just knowing that there are things in there that aren't accurate, this is the next story he brings about Rabbi Yaakov Pollack. And he brings an incident where a Jew entrusted 12,000 gold pieces for safekeeping with another Jew as a shomechinam. When he came back for his property, the other person denied the whole incident. The plaintiff came to Rav Avraham Mintz and presented his case. The defendant went to other rabbinical authorities, and rulings in Italy became going back and forth. What ended up happening is that Rabbi Yaakov Pollack criticized Rav Mintz's position. And I don't know which one took which side. Pashtus is the guy who swears and he's putter. Like, I don't know if there are, what more the details are. But what ended up happening, Shalshelas HaKabbalah says they both Rav Pollack was critical of Rav Mintz. Rav Mintz wrote back. Eventually both sides excommunicated each other, and it was confirmed by the scholars of Italy that they both died on the same day. So this is another story in the Shalshelas HaKabbalah. Again, it just, I mean, like, this seems to be just, okay, I don't know, I just taking the Rashi Pratim of it, the idea that there was some sort of a controversy and it ended up in excommunication. I mean, just sounds like in a simple case is a simple halacha, but I guess it must have been more involved. Now, this is what happened. Okay, he set up a yeshiva of Pollack, and he had hundreds of talmidim, thousands of talmidim. I mean, this was for 30 years, and he brought pilpul with him, and that excited the masses. You know, got them all into learning, you know, different splits and try to get, you know, it was just a revival, an explosion. It was just in terms of learning in Poland, it was like some sort of like a shot in the arm, something new that just carried the day and got Poland into learning like nothing else. In the year 1503, he was appointed chief Krakow, rabbi of Krakow, 30 years. He had famous disciples, among them Shalom Shachna, who later became the Rav of Lublin. Okay, now there was another controversy, and this is the story, and probably this happened to he had to run for his life, and this probably could have been because of the excommunications. It was a story where this man was a couple who was married, and there were witnesses that came in and said that there was a man who was menayef the woman. So she, the wife of this couple, had an affair with somebody else, with another Jewish man, and with witnesses, Rabbi Yaakov Pollack, paskin that the man and the woman had to get divorced, and that was it. It was a shameful thing. The only thing was, is who? Do I have it here? No. Okay, who was the menayef? Who was the one that was the adulterer? It happened to have been a Jewish doctor in the royal court of the king who had a lot of influence. And he was very embarrassed by that because his name came out that he was the adulterer, and this they believed the testimony of the witnesses. The man and the woman had to get divorced, and it didn't look good for this guy. So he went to the king. So the king called in Rabbi Yaakov Pollock, and he says, "Listen, you got to do something here. First of all, we want you to paskin, you know, allow them to get remarried, and I want you to get up and make a publicly and swear publicly that it was wrong. This doctor never did anything wrong." And that was what he was forced to do by the king. So what do you do when the king tells you to do that?
Run
for your life. And that's what he did. So he had to leave after 30 years of being there. He had to run. He ran to Eretz Yisrael, spent 10 years about in Eretz Yisrael, in Yerushalayim. From there he went to Turkey, and towards the end of his life he had to run. He settled back in Poland and Lublin, probably in obscurity, because he was probably a wanted felon. And that was that's how he ended his life. It's a sad situation. Probably, again, cherims and excommunications are not something to take light. Okay. But when he left, the next Rav was Rav Shalom Shachar. Again, just Rav Shalom Shachar, great rabbi. Also, he was a top student of Rav Pollock. He was there till 1558. So from about 1530 to about 1558, also 20 years. About almost 30 years. He spread Torah throughout around Poland and Rezin, and this is all in the Sefer Tzemach David. Sefer Masas Binyamin says, "I saw the great mentor of Shachna, who is an unusually great outstanding scholar, mentor of all my mentors, as well as the greats of the generation." So Rav Shachna also was the Rebbe of the Ramah as well. This is the Beis Shmuel. Rav Shachna written is with a chaf, is derived from the word Shechina. Therefore, the Gaon Rav Shachna, blessed memory, gave himself the mnemonic, the Shechno Tidrush. Okay? This is the Ramah. He says, "I received practical direction in Halacha from my guide, my father." It's really his father-in-law, the Gaon, master of light of the entire diaspora. So this is the Ramah writing about his father-in-law. Rav Shalom, who was known as Rav Shachno, memory of a righteous next world, I'm willing to undergo any suffering, that may be his lot, to establish many disciples from one end of the world to the next, from whose mouth ushered life, I swear by my life, all the words of my together with many scholars, I asked him to make a work of his rulings. So I asked Rav Shachno to write and make a sefer. What is his psakos? He replied in his piety, humility, that he won't do it. I don't want the world to rely on me. If there would be an argument between the authorities, he would rule according to one of them, or at times he would argue with an authority. A judge should rule according to the way he sees the matter. All right, he felt in his humility that his works weren't, worthy of his psukos, his learning wasn't worthy of writing down something which Ramah did not, Baruch Hashem, did not feel that way, because the Ramah, today we learn everything from the Ramah. Our Shulchan Aruch all comes from the Ramah. Therefore, each should rule according to the circumstances. Okay. That's the Tshuva's Ramah. Okay, this is written on his gravestone. The stone, man resting place, he writes, he restored the crown of Torah, established many disciples. From all generations derived sustenance from his mouth. They continued to drink from his waters. Behold, the illustrious crown over the thousands of Israel. Wonder of the generation, majesty. Okay, you see that all the beautiful accolades that he deserved. Rav Shalom, known as Rav Shachna ben Rav Yosef, was a blessing into the next world. Pious and humble, was gathered to his people Friday Rosh Chodesh 1558. May his soul be bound up. Life, okay. This is the inscription of Rav Shachna's gravestone. Okay, what I'd like to do now is just go a little bit into what this pilpul was. So first of all, the yeshivas had a different type of a seder. Now, before you do that, one of the many people wrote against this pilpul. So one of the strongest voices against it was the Arch HaSadikim. The Arch HaSadikim was written around this time. It was written anonymously. they all think he was from France and, you know, made his way to Italy or Poland, or you know, maybe didn't make his way to Poland, but he writes like this. I'm just going to take the early generations gave their lives for study of Torah. They knew without great analysis the entire Talmud, the commentary and Tosfos. And then he brings that great scholars came, condensed later Tosfos him. But even in those days, they were expert in the entire Talmud and the Tosfos. And that's what everybody knew. Everybody knew Kol HaTorah Kula. They studied all of Shas, and they knew Shas and Tosfos. And they wouldn't stop and just stop to think about one, just think about one part and spend a lot of time on that one part. Their essential emphasis is reviewing the material. Okay, in this generation, however, the Torah has become forgotten. This is because the scholars think that they can do as the earlier generations and put great emphasis on Pilpul. They're not, however, in nowhere comparison to the scholars of France. They confuse each other, rather that's not the case today, rather confuse each other with their arguments and waste most of the day. Wow. They spend about half a day doing this. Their real studies are done haphazardly, but wasting time in these Pilpulim is a fixed part of their day. You know, when they have to learn Bikias, they're not set with it. They do it, okay, a little Bikias here and there, but they spend all their time learning Pilpul. How can we ever be able to understand the now, because of great effort, he also says that, what are they spending their effort? Instead of spending their effort of learning entire Shas, they spend their great effort trying to understand the Svara. And he says, people actually stop learning. How can we ever be able to understand the logic that's not implicit in the text? We wish we would first know what's contained in the text itself, which I'll explain. A lot of Pilpul is trying to figure out what the Gemara is not saying. Whereas we do like what the Shalah is going to say about this, but we're going to see because of their immense imagination, study of Pilpul, they're achieving expertise neither in Torah, prophets, neither in Midrash. Okay, so you could see Shar Chav Zayin. You could see the Aruch HaTzaddikim was not in favor of Pilpul. Rav Moshe Mintz, the students absent themselves from their teachers during the daily Talmudic studies. They sit by themselves to deeply analyze the material. Also not a fan. Rav Yaakov Weil, Rav Yisrael Wisselin should... Okay, he's writing a tshuva. And basically, he hears he heard a tshuva from Rav Yisrael Wisselin, who was the great Rav, and he found a heter to allow an almana to get remarried from a pilpul that he made up. So Rav Yaakov Weil is saying, I can't believe he would do such a thing. How could Rav Yaakov Weil find some heter that's not explicitly out in the text? And that's what he said. You should think, Yisrael Isselin should think that he would be able to rule leniently to allow a married woman to remarry on the basis of a mere inference in the wording of the text. Certainly when we're engaged in pilpul and learn incisively, as in the time allowed during the Tosfos Zman, which we'll see what maybe that is soon. It is then the practice to weigh arguments and to make every effort and inferences and learn. But Pilpul, there's time for it. There's a time and place for it. But not when you're giving a psak. Okay, you want to make a Pilpulim. But psak has to be straight from the Gemara. That's basically what he said. Talmud Yerushalmi does bring down about Pilpul. Rav Avohu said these arguments are appropriate when we are involved in the give and take of the subject matter. That's Pilpul. That's a quoting of Talmud Yerushalmi. Trumas Hadeshin, it's extremely difficult to make distinctions on one own which are not hinted in the Talmud, in the Gemara itself. The Leket Yosher, he says he remembers once Rabbi Yisrael Isserlin said, Hashem should forgive me for my limited understanding because the Pilpul that I just made is not worthy of Berachas HaTorah. So it was like an intellectual gymnastic exercise, but it wasn't real Torah. It wasn't emes. So even Rabbi Yisrael said about this one piece that he did was extreme. It wasn't really necessarily true. That's Leket Yosher is quoting that he heard the Rabbi Yisrael Isserlin. Okay, I just want to go a little further. The Ramak also here. The Ramak starts to try to explain what the Zman was. So it seems that they would spend half the year going through the Masechta, and then the next half a year going through the Tosfos of the Masechta. It was called the Tosfos Man. So different, I don't know if all the yeshivas did like this, but this is the way he's quoting. Tosfos Man, the custom is study one term, which lasted half a year, the Halachos, without Tosfos, and the second half of the year with Tosfos, okay. But Naftali Hertz, that's what he in Beis Hillel. He brings a story where Reb Elio Kapsali is describing the yeshiva of Reb Yehuda Mintz. This is what they would do. This is what the daily routine was. They would after davening, they would walk to the courtyard. This was called the yeshiva, a large building in the courtyard. At the time, the other rabbis and students would gather. Each rabbi would begin to ask questions, and each one would answer, each one according to his rank. Afterwards, each one would ask and answer, bring light to which was hidden. This was called the pilpul of the yeshiva. Each one would engage in pilpul with his learning partner. The pilpul was conducted outside. I mean to say, there was no sefer that was opened at the time. They had a kasha and an answer. How would you say? Could you answer like this? Could you answer like that? Maybe you could say like this. But if maybe you could, he could hold like this, or he could hold like this. And then afterwards, the only sefer present was the Talmud in front of the Rav, which he used to show them the halacha. They would do this for about an hour, and then the Rav would open the sefer and tell them the correct extent of what the halacha was, I guess what the Gemara was. Okay, that's Reb Elio Kapsali describing the yeshiva of Reb Yehuda Mintz. And then they would all go with their Rebbe and prepare for the next day. That's how it was done. Okay, I just want to get to, again, another sefer calling it not Pilpul, but Bilbul. Okay, there was a story where they brought this Reb Chaim Karmi, an outstanding scholar from France. So he came to the yeshiva of a Pilpul yeshiva and says, what's going on here? So they said that they, first of all, in order for him to understand, they held the discussions in the Holy Tongue. So does it mean that they held it in Yiddish, or maybe since he was from France at the time, he didn't know Yiddish, so they held it in Hebrew? But he writes that this, he was there, and when he saw that they did not act towards each other in a calm, respectful manner, he left, never returned. This is Reb Chaim Karmi. Because he saw when they're arguing, and they're screaming at each other, how could you say that? And they got very loud and vocal, and it was not something that Karmi was used to. Okay? What did I want to get to? Okay. There are a few things, just like a few ideas. What is Pilpul? What were they doing? So, again, these are from Svarim that came later that were trying to explain what they did. So one thing is, and we all do this in learning today, but to a certain extent. It's not the main part of learning. There's something called a svara mibachutz, or a svara chitzona, and that is as follows. If you were to go ahead and you were to hear a statement, okay, and you would say, well, what do you think that is? So you would say, well, I think it's, I'm just throwing it out, I think it's permitted because of the following. And then you'd look at the Gemara, and the Gemara says, it is permitted because of the following. You got it exactly right. So I guess many people would say, great, I understand the Gemara, let's go further. So somebody else would say, wait a minute. You know, if you got it right, and this is what the Gemara is saying, that's so obvious, why'd the Gemara have to write it? In other words, it must have been a different svara, a different logic that would say that it's forbidden. What is that logic? In other words, why is the Gemara having to write something obvious that it's permitted? There must be some sort of logic to forbid it. And the Gemara is then saying, no, it's permitted. What? So now, why is it forbidden? Why would you think it's forbidden? Now, that's nothing to do with the Gemara. You're coming up with a sfer mibachutz to try to figure out what, you know. People would say, it's not obvious, the Gemara had to say it, let's go further. But they would now have to try to figure out some logic why it's forbidden, but the Gemara is going to end off that it's permitted. Others would do the, you do it, and you'd say, you know what, I think it's forbidden. And then you look, and the Gemara says it's permitted. Okay, so now, why am I wrong? Why is the Gemara feeling that it's permitted and I'm wrong? So again, you're coming up with splits, and you're coming up with reasons and logics, all not in the Gemara. That's one type of a pilpul that you could... So there is a place for this. There is room for this. And if it's done in the right way, in the right amount, yeah, it's understandable. Sometimes it doesn't make sense, or it sounds like it really should be the other way. Why is the Gemara, in fact, not using the most logical way? So there is reason sometimes to look into what the Svarim Mibachutz is. Another thing. Okay, so he just spells that out. Know what the alternative explanation, logical, he's coming to reject or exclude. When it was a power splitting, well, okay. Okay, now these are others, types of pilpul. They had something called the Ausbrenger problems, the Nuremberger problems, and the Regensburger problems. Now, we know Nuremberg and Regensburg are cities in Germany. And Nuremberg, we saw that was the yeshiva that Rapala came from, and they were into pilpul. So what the Ausbrenger is maybe Augsburg, because we do know that maybe they named it after them. Okay, and then they have Vimtoma problems and Tama problems. So I'll just see if I could just maybe do one or two more. Okay, the Shalah, okay, he brings down in his learning, he says, you know, and he brings down a lot of these pilpulim to work on, and he says in certain cases, yes, this is the way to learn. But other times, you don't need to. So I'll give you one example that he says. Okay, here's one. The Gemara goes ahead and brings down a brisa, okay, and asks Akasha, okay? Or let's say, a person, an Amora is a rabbi at the time of the Gemara, who came after the time of the Mishnah. I guess it's really important to know there are two time periods in the Gemara. There's the Tanayim, which is the Mishnah time period, and then there's a later time period, which is the Gemara time period. The transition was Rebbe HaKodesh, Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi. So if you were before Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi, you were a Tana, and after Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi, you were an Amora. Okay? If you came after Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi, you cannot argue on a Tana. They all agreed that from that generation on, after Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi wrote the Mishnah, and there were brisos, which are Mishnayos that didn't make it in, so that's it. You can't, that was the cutoff. So you have afterwards Amorayim. So let's say an Amora would make a statement. So every statement that an Amora makes has to fit into a Mishnah and or a brisa. But if you found a Mishnah or a brisa that was arguing on what this Amora said, that's a problem. So the Gemara would bring that down. How could you say that this is permitted? I have a brisa or a Mishnah that says it's forbidden. So the Gemara will discuss it. You try to give various answers. The brisa could be talking about in one case, and the Mishnah and the Amora is talking about a different case. However, the Gemara is going to resolve it. Sometimes there's a brisa that's brought down, and the question is from the last line of the brisa. But they bring a brisa which is like a few lines, and the brisa goes on and on and on, and on the last line, they ask, the kasha is from that last line of the brisa. So the question is, why did they bring the whole brisa? Just bring the last line. So the pilpul, what they used to do is, that's called the icebringer. Why'd you bring that's called the fairbringer. Why'd you bring the first part? You don't need the first part, you just need the last part. Sometimes the questions from the first line of the brisa, or the Mishnah, the brisa, and why do you bring the rest of the brisa? So the answer is, so what do they have to find? Why bring it? So they find like this. The reason why the Gemara brought the entire Brisa is because from the other text, from the rest of the Brisa, you would have a simple answer, but you couldn't bring the answer because of the rest of the text. In other words, the rest of the text is going to add to the question against this person. And that's basically it. Yeah, it does what? How? So that's what you have to find out. That's what Pilpul will do. Okay, why do we bring this whole thing? We only have a question here. Because if you're going to try to answer this, you can't, because that would be a problem with something earlier in the Brisa or something later in the Brisa. So it's all outside, nothing to do with the Gemara. Some actually would want to give an answer. You know why they brought the entire thing? Because since the entire, sometimes, you know, the one who wrote the Gemara, you know, felt really the questioner just brought that small part. And that's it. He only asked one line. I have a Brisa, and he asked the question. But the one who wrote the Gemara wanted to preserve the Brisa. How else are you going to remember the rest of the Brisa? So he took the entire Brisa and he put it in. So your question doesn't begin at all. Why do you bring in the whole Brisa? Because we wanted to preserve the Brisa. If we didn't preserve the Brises in the Gemara, they'd be lost. They'd be forgotten. And that's why you brought it in. So the Shalah says, basically, it's a good question you could ask these ice-bringers or fear-bringers only if it makes sense to ask. If it's something obvious in the first part or the last part that would contradict, that was necessary for the answer, then it's proper to ask. Okay, and so you see a lot of these questions are all based on nothing that's in the Gemara. You have to use your own logic. It's like, you know, filling out a piece and using your own logic to come in and to explain it. In the beginning, it doesn't seem that the Rashi Yeshivas were coming up with their own pilpulim, you know, structures. It seems that they were just like almost like a referee, and they're listening. They're listening to what everybody has to say, and they're saying this is right, this is wrong. But it seems that later on, the Rosh Hashivas gave their own pilpulim. This is, what do you think of this? I have this question, this, and I could answer using this, so they themselves gave it. So that was what the pilpul was. Today, we generally don't learn this way. You know, again, there are proper times to use it when it's logical and it makes sense. So I guess we don't have time more, but the Shalah brings all different, he goes through different types of these pulpulim, and basically, generally, he says when it makes sense to ask, it's a proper question. If you're going to say something that's crazy, then you could just say it was brought in because you wanted to preserve it. Okay, so that, I guess, concludes. Any questions? Rav Palak, Rav Shachna, and a little bit about what Pilpul was.